Thank you very much, Robin. We have had a couple of questions already. There's one from an Italian doctor, Emanuela, who's in Mozambique working for an agency there, and also Robin, a dietitian, both going around the topic of masks. Firstly, there's a lack of clarity. The CDC says the public should wear masks. I don't know where the World Health Organization stands on it or the Department of Health. So should the general public be wearing surgical masks? And since there's a shortage of surgical masks, the point that Emanuela raises is, can one use homemade masks as long as one changes them regularly and they are properly washed? And similarly with surgical masks, do they demand a daily change, or can they be properly reprocessed so that they are again sterile and usable?
Well, I think the first point is if we have a limited supply of high quality N95 masks, they have to be prioritized towards the healthcare workers. I mean, in Italy, I think 10 to 20% of the epidemic impacted healthcare workers. So they are a particularly vulnerable group. We need them to carry on working. So we need to focus sophisticated masks towards that population. As far as the data, it's always interesting that whenever one organization comes out and is definitely against it and another organization comes out and is promoting it, it usually is indicative that we actually don't know what's going on. And I think that's part of the reason why we're getting different answers from the CDC and the WHO. I think the data that's coming out is that wearing a mask is certainly very good as a philanthropic activity. So you're not going to cough your larger aerosols at other people. It's going to be captured. The question is, how safe is it for protecting you against large particles? Probably reasonable. Protecting you against small particles, less so. But any protection is better than none. And if everybody wore masks, it certainly would decrease transmission because you won't be donating your organisms to other people without knowing it. So I would support masks. I think there's some data coming out of design of masks with other materials. And that's the big variable. So are you using two layers of cotton? Can you get access to, there's an interesting material that's in large supplies used for sterilization of surgical equipment. And that has been designed into a mask by the Florida anesthetists. So it's a rapidly moving field. I would personally be supportive. I can't see the downside. The fear that it might siphon off equipment from the people who need it, I think it just has to be dealt with. But there is a protective degree of protection from that, and I would be supportive of it.
Thanks, Robin. There's another question that actually flows from that. It's from Aaron Heyman in Cape Town, a GP, who says that the current practice that Dr. Heyman is following is to consult all patients using a Perspex visor and then also to use one of the only N95 masks that he's managed to scavenge, and which he then tries not to touch the outside of the mask, and is wondering if he could microwave them for continued usage.
I think moved a little bit out of my field of expertise on the microwavability of different materials. I have a sort of vision of the whole thing melting, but I think you can swab it down with alcohol. You could dip it in, I think, 2% bleach. It has to be not thermo softening to put into the oven for 30 minutes or into a microwave. So I'm afraid I couldn't give a recommendation to use the microwave. I have a sort of feel that it might not be a great idea. But if he's got access to alcohol, then swab it down with alcohol. That would be pretty good.
A question from Marcus. What infection control measures would you suggest in informal settlements? That's Marcus Lowe from Spotlight.
That's interesting, and I think that's where the role of personal masks, first of all, if we can get the right material or substitute materials into the townships, there are many skilled seamstresses that could make masks, so it would be a question of education, giving them sort of some quality control. You can hold them up to the light to see if light comes through, for instance, but I think that's something that could be scaled up very rapidly and would create local employment. I think the more sophisticated medical interventions are going to be, unfortunately, not available. So then we come back to social distancing. I think that's has practical problems when you're living very close to people, other people. I think I am concerned about the taxis and crowding of people in taxis. The worst sort of mixing that can happen is so-called general mixing, where you meet different people each time. When you're in your own home, you meet the same people each time. That's called associative. And as far as an epidemic is concerned, it's the generalized mixing. So if you go to a big meeting with a church meeting with hundreds of people, or a scientific meeting with hundreds of people, that's the big risk. So you need to avoid those type of meetings. But as far as a sort of medical intervention, I would be supportive of using masks on a wide scale.
A question from Professor to you from Stuart, who says, what is your opinion regarding the possible protective effect from BCG immunization? And what would your advice be to President Ramaphosa after the 21-day lockdown?
So that's a fascinating question. BCG is a complex intervention. It was used in the UK from 1940s, I think, until as late as 2006 or something like that. So there's a whole cohort of people who've been infected, been given the vaccine. I would expect that Boris Johnson would have been given the vaccine, and he's suffering from COVID at the moment. So it's not going to be... it's going to be more of an epidemiological interest. I don't think it's going to have a role of suddenly scaling it up. The ability to manufacture it's going to be not that easy. The next thing is it could be a two-edged sword. Part of the problem from the disease is the viral replication itself, but it does appear that in some patients an over-exuberant immune system may be partially causing respiratory failure. So it's an interesting observation. I don't think it's going to be a realistic intervention that we can do, but it would be interesting to see whether some of the age distribution of the disease and severity of the disease was historically related to exposure to that. In this country, all children are given it soon after birth. And if it does have protection effect, that would really be one of the positive features for us.
Robin Janella asks, the World Health Organization and the Minister of Health are telling us that this virus is not transmitted as an aerosol, but only as droplets. Kindly discuss the evidence for transmission as an aerosol.
So that really comes down to understanding the nature of particles. So large particles have large mass, a third power of their radius, and they have momentum. And that's why they can be projected over long distances by coughs. And because of their size, if you looked for the virus, you're going to find much more virus in big particles than you would in small. On the other hand, as I sort of pointed out, peripheral lung particles can be produced by deep breathing and other respiratory activities. So probably both are going to take place. And the one is easier to deal with. Any form of mask is going to take out the big particles. But we still have the problem that 20% of healthcare workers in Spain and Italy are getting infected. That would seem highly unlikely from large particles. So again, when a lot of people are making these statements and understanding the mechanisms behind are probably more important. So the quantity of transmission from one or the other is probably going to vary on the site and the environment, what conditions they're in. But I would come out and say there is definitely going to be some transmission from small particles. And that's why N95 masks are used in invasive situations where aerosols are likely. Aerosols are only small particles, less than 5 microns, remain airborne for long periods of time. And obviously, if it's a well-ventilated area, it's not going to be a problem. If it's not a well-ventilated area, then I think it is a problem. That's another interesting one that came out is how did the tiger in the US get infected by its handler? It's unlikely that they cuddle together very much, and one would imagine that it's that. So there are some puzzles on transmission. So we don't understand all the mechanisms of transmission. So we're working from epidemiological data and from mechanistic data that we have.
Can you clarify something that you spoke of earlier? And that's the difference, the testing for upper and lower respiratory testing. Which one of the listeners asked, did you say is more sensitive?
The most sensitive was the invasive bronchoalveolar lavage, which is a way of taking a sample from the peripheral lung. But as I pointed out, you only tend to do that in the sickest patients. So these are obviously patients with respiratory disease, peripheral lung disease, and therefore that would be the appropriate sample for those. Interestingly, for TB, it's also the most sensitive. And the research that I've been doing was a way of capturing that fluid without having to be invasive. So, does that answer the question?
I think so, yes. Robin Sagers asked, do you suggest healthcare workers wear N95 masks for all interactions with patients? The World Health Organization guideline regarding rational use of PPE suggests N95 masks should only be used for aerosol-generating procedures, and surgical masks would suffice for other interactions.
So, again, one of the words in there was really related to resource allocation. So it's a logical thing when we've got a shortage of high-efficiency mechanisms. Again, I'd point out that there is a great failure rate of the current strategies in Italy and in Spain. So there has to be a rational use of resources, but you're titrating the level of medical sophistication with the risk, and there is never a zero risk. So it looks as though in South Korea, the ambulance workers and the nurses use facial shields with filtered air going across them. Could we do that here? No, we couldn't, because we don't have the equipment. So a large amount of these recommendations are coming on what is practical at the moment rather than what is optimal. I would suggest that the optimum is to use the maximum effective device that you can afford. And that's why we finish up with some sort of practical recommendations of surgical versus N95 masks and community cloth masks. I mean, it's basically titrating what we have against the numbers and the need.
Let's go back to those cloth masks. Two aspects. The one is, can they be cleaned and reused? Well, obviously they're going to have to be cleaned and reused. And if so, how does one do it? And then Erica Lazarus says that there's some recommendations for cycling masks, using a new mask on day one and then day two, and then again on day six, begin using number one again. Any views on that?
That's an interesting strategy. Again, what we're doing is we're titrating the utility against the availability. There's been a few studies on survival of the virus in the environment, and it seems as though after a few days, it doesn't survive well. So that would be an interesting thing with the cycling of masks. I think that hot water washing is suitable. Putting things into an oven at 120 degrees for 30 minutes would be soaking in chlorine in bleach is probably going to destroy the rubber and a few other things. There are many ways of cleaning, and I probably think that normal washing would probably be, hot water washing would probably be satisfactory, but it's an interesting suggestion of the cycling, because then you're taking advantage of the limited survival of the virus on materials. And if you know that it doesn't survive for more than 72 hours, then having four masks rotation would work, but I'm not sure about that data.
Erica Lazarus asks, if masks are not used by everybody, could they become a fomite? For instance, asymptomatically or mildly symptomatic non-mask wearers expel viruses which are then picked up by someone else's mask, which is then touched, pulled up, used incorrectly, and then you may as well deal with it at the same time. What about the risk of contamination from masks if touched frequently and not taken off properly or disposed of properly?
I mean, unfortunately, this is a problem with all the interventions we've got. I mean, N95 masks have to be used properly. We have to train people to do it. So it's not an easy thing to do. If you have gloves and aprons, the taking off and putting on of that is important. I think to throw your hands up and say, well, you know, it could all cause damage, it could do, but I think we just have to educate people on the proper use of these and give practical suggestions of how people can clean them. But I don't think there's any evidence that the COVID epidemic has been driven by the use of masks. I think all the evidence is really the other way. So yes, there are possibilities that you could get your mask and push it in someone else's face or do something equally horrendous, but I don't think that's a reason to not use them. There's no evidence that they have done large amounts of harm at a population level.
There's a very technical question from Francois van Weyck. Is this primarily a respiratory disease? Lung expression of ACE2 receptors is less than other ACE2 expressing tissues.
It certainly looks as though it's a respiratory disease. We diagnose it by taking respiratory samples. There's been work looking at the quantitative production of viral particles from nasal swabs, and it shows that shedding takes place before symptoms. Symptoms develop and then shedding decreases. So it gives us an insight into asymptomatic transmission, but we're finding the virus in the air and in the respiratory tract, and the respiratory tract is a well-known way of spreading respiratory viruses with our annual flu and coughs and colds, etc. So yes, I think it's primarily a respiratory disease, although there's some evidence that it can affect other organs, and some of the sudden deaths that occur have been postulated to be receptor concentrations in vascular tissue or in other vital organs. But the definition of a respiratory disease means it affects the respiratory tract and is probably transmitted via respiratory activities.
Robin, a GP, Chris Lewis, asks, could a young, naive immune system be protective? And similarly, could patients on immunosuppressants be potentially, i.e. could biologicals be potentially protective?
Yes, an interesting question. My wife got her PhD on TNF, tumor necrosis factor blockade of diseases, and certainly, the immune system is very complex. Sometimes it's overactive, sometimes it's underactive. That is an interesting approach of the use of biologicals. Tend to be most effective when there's an overactive immune system, and that could be part of the so-called ARDS respiratory syndrome. The other thing that this question touches on is the age distribution. And generally, it seems as though young children respond to many of our common illnesses in a different way from adults, so that if you get chickenpox at the age of five, you have a much more benign illness than if you had it at the age of 25 for the first time, when you finish up on a respiratory ventilator with chickenpox pneumonia. So there is a difference in age responses to diseases. TB is lethal for very young children, is fairly innocuous between the golden age of 5 to 14. So there are age responses. On the other hand, I think that the age distribution of viral diseases is probably related to more to herd immunity. So the 1918 flu was particularly vicious because the last 20 years before that, there hadn't been an exposure to the H1N1 virus, and that's why it affected the young soldiers and teenagers rather than the old and the young. So it's often a clue that when you see these unusual age distributions, that it may be reflecting prior exposure to cross-reacting viruses. In fact, just as a sort of aside, my son is a veterinary surgeon, and he has postulated to me that because coronaviruses are so common amongst his animal patients, that could it be that he's protected in some way? And it's an interesting question, and people are looking to see what the incidence of COVID is amongst veterinary personnel. So there's a lot of complexity to this, but age distribution, I think, often gives us some interesting clues. And I think that may be the case when we look particularly at the disease in Africa.
Robin, can we take two treatment-related questions? One from Tracy van Rensburg, who asked, is there any support for any specific micronutrient supplementation? For instance, she noticed some guidelines recommending high doses of vitamin C, vitamin D, and zinc. And then to the more controversial one, is there a role for chloroquine in the management of COVID-19, both as prophylaxis and as treatment?
So the vitamin story is quite interesting. Our focus on the disease is to try and stop people getting disease with the social mixing. And then when they get disease, we sort of ignore them until they come with severe symptoms. And then we throw our high-tech medical interventions at them. So that in-between part for people who've been infected and not seriously ill, they get sent home. And certainly there may be interventions and care for that during that period that might decrease the chances of progression to serious disease. Certainly, generally, vitamins and supplements are most effective in people who are deficient of those. Very little evidence that super doses of them can be beneficial, but it's an interesting window where we're actually not doing anything at that stage, and I think it's would be an interesting focus. The next one is chloroquine, which is a very interesting drug. The data is a little bit confusing in that there's been small studies which show that it might have some effect. It certainly has a level of complexity of impact on intracellular vesicles and on expression of immune markers. So it has potential, but we do have conflicting data. And when you get conflicting data, either the data is wrong or each of the studies was done in a slightly different population. So when you do the study in very, very sick patients and look sort of death at the endpoint, it's pretty tough to expect the drug to do much. If, on the other hand, you were looking at it as a preventative, it would be easier to show, but those studies require large numbers of individuals to do. So it's still a bit of an open question. It's a readily available drug. It's got a lot of experience in it, and it really requires a better testing with well-defined population groups, because it may work better in some than in others. But the data, unfortunately, is not sufficient really to come down definitely on that. But it's a relatively well tolerated at the doses we're using, and there's a lot of experience, and it's licensed and out there, so it's available. So that's why naturally people will tend to use it. The data is just missing. We need more data.
Gail Mkele asks, on the Solidarity Clinical Trial, is South Africa part of this trial, which I think it is. Any information also on how lopinavir and ritonavir works or is thought to work against the coronavirus?
I think the evidence for lopinavir, ritonavir is not positive. The theory is that it's basically a protease inhibitor, and there is a protease phase of the life cycle of COVID. But I think there's not much positive data on that. So if you were to sort of hierarchy drugs that are going to be tested, I think the Gilead drug up front, chloroquine there, and this would be much lower down. Although I think it has been added into the one of the arms of the study that is being run by the WHO.
Anita Michelle asks, is the period of exposure to a shedding person likely to have an influence on the likelihood of one's infection?
Well, I think some of the modelling papers suggest that the epidemic is driven by asymptomatics. The viral shedding data showed that the shedding was highest early on. So that makes it a very difficult disease to control if we have patients that we can't diagnose that are infective. So what we do now is say, well, they're contacts, and therefore we will treat the contacts differently from the general population and put them into isolation. I think asymptomatic shedding is really quite worrying because you can't identify it very easily, and you would need very widespread testing to identify those people. So it's greatly in favor of the virus and its spread and against its control.
Another person asked whether you would mind commenting on the various agents that are being tested as antiviral agents. For example, ivermectin.
Yeah, so it's a lot of anecdotal evidence. Each of these are drugs that have some sort of rational use, and at this sort of stage, you often get a little bit of interesting data. I think that the WHO approach to use a multi-armed comparison of these studies, of these drugs, is the only real way forward. They all have some interest, and they'll have their protagonist, but we're basically swimming in a data-free zone.
And that's really what makes it so difficult for the government to know what to do. Given the fact that if social contact is limited in public and people are using masks, and I'm going to ask perhaaps a very unfair question, what is your feeling about relaxing the current lockdown, or certainly how do you see it playing out? Are we being too restrictive in our initial response?
Yeah, that's interesting. Time will tell. If the politicians had not done anything, they'd be accused of being remiss. It does seem as though they were working on the premise that we would be seeing more cases. We're suffering from our testing. We're not testing enough, really, to be able to say that the cases have decreased. But probably better to be accused of doing too much than too little in the present environment, certainly looking at the disasters that are occurring in Europe. The theory of flattening of the curve is an interesting one, and it's based on not overwhelming your health facilities. The question, which I haven't seen in the models, is what is the area under the curve? Does the area under the curve of a flat curve, is it less? Does that mean eventually that less people will be infected with this than if you have a rapid? And we don't really know the answer to those questions. So It's incumbent on us to try and decrease mortality and overwhelming of the health system in the short term. The middle and long term responses to this, whether we will get a second wave, et cetera, are more complex to know. Time will tell. Certainly in the 1918 flu epidemic, the second wave in the second year, 1919, was much more severe than the first. But I think the natural instinct to try and decrease impact in the short term is admirable. What it will do in the long term is going to be dependent on herd immunity, but we don't have any way of measuring that at the moment. The new tests might allow us to do that. So I think the humane response is what has taken place. Where we will go, unfortunately, we need time.
Robert, we're running out of time, but I'd like to ask you a final question. There are other questions which we haven't had time to address, and I'd appreciate it if you just look at them as some that you might be able to give a quick response to, some very technical questions of availability of drugs, etc. But I wonder if you could say, Teresa Rousseau asks, could you please say something about the viability and durability of coronavirus on surfaces and objects?
Some of the data that I've looked at suggests reasonably long-term, and that would be sort of 72 hours survival on surfaces. It was an interesting observation that I think the shortest was on copper. We always tend to think of silver as an antibacterial and anti-infective, but copper surfaces seem to be the shortest. The problem is that what you're doing there is you're looking at sort of artificial survival rather than the ability to infect another person or organism. We normally rely on that closing of that loop on animal models and then extrapolate to humans. But certainly it looks as though the virus can be cultured up to a day or two on certain surfaces.
Thank you very much, Professor Wood. I'm sorry that we don't have more time for more questions, but thank you very much for participating, everyone.
Thank you, William. It's been a pleasure.